Can you hear me okay, Your Honors? Can you hear me okay?
If you can bring a little bit closer. Okay.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, very good. Our power's on. Yeah. Okay.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Ariel Eshtamkar on behalf of the State of Oregon and state defendants. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Defendants presented ample evidence that the Oregon Department of Corrections, or ODOC, conducts individualized assessments to determine housing for transgender women consistent with its policies, and plaintiffs presented no evidence to the contrary. The district court substituted its assumptions for evidence in the record and found that ODOC employs the default presumption of housing transgender women in men's facilities.
Do you challenge the district court's finding with respect to, I guess, the credibility of the declarations that were submitted and the lack of what the district court thought was sufficient evidence to rebut those, and taking as true that those events occurred and that these risks were therefore realized and that the ODOC was aware of that? Are you challenging that determination?
Your Honor, I think the district court's determination with respect to weighing the evidence was erroneous because it wasn't an instance where plaintiffs have made an affirmative showing, and the district court simply weighed or discredited the evidence from defendants. This was a case where there was no evidence offered by plaintiffs.
Now, I understand you say there's no evidence of the default presumption in terms of how the practice is operated. My question was a smaller one of whether or not you're challenging the aspect of the district court's findings that related to these specific occurrences of harm to the declarants. Are you challenging that and the ODOC's awareness of those?
I think, Your Honor, defendants are not challenging the declarations and the specific instances of harm described in those declarations, although they are inconsistent with the declarations that defendants had offered to the district court.
So for purposes of our proceeding, we take as true that those events as described there occurred and the district court's findings as to those specific incidents to those persons did occur.
Your Honor, I think there are declarations that the district court discredited that were offered by defendants that spoke to the instances of harm allegedly suffered by plaintiffs. I think the district court's weighing of defendants' evidence was also premised on this clearly erroneous factual finding of the default
presumption.
Okay, so
you are challenging all the facts, or you think that the error on the presumption evidence sort of just carried over, had a spillover, and affected and contaminated the assessment of all of the declarations?
That's correct, Your
Honor.
Okay. The district court here substituted its assumptions for evidence in the record and found that ODOC employs the default presumption for housing transgender women in men's facilities. And based on that finding, it provisionally certified a class of all transgender women in custody.
Now, counsel, I would like to return briefly to Judge Collins' line of questioning. Say we disagree with you and we say there's no clear error with respect to the district court's findings as to the individual instances of harm with respect to the plaintiff JF, LB, SS, Jane Doe. Would you lose or would you still win? What's your position there?
Your Honor, I don't think we would lose. I think as this court noted in its stay order, individual instances of harm, even crediting those, would support at most individual redress of particular constitutional violations, but they would not justify the class-wide relief that the district court ordered here.
But the plaintiffs don't just have those individual instances. They have individual instances plus statistics. The DOJ study, as well as statistics derived from the department's own records. 90%+ of transgender inmates are placed presumptively, according to plaintiffs, in men's prisons. So it's not just the individual instances, it's individual instances plus the statistical figures that they offer. Why isn't that enough for the district court to have made its conclusion? Isn't that enough record support?
Your Honor, I think there are 2 points here. The first is that the national statistic that plaintiffs have cited was not specific to Oregon. As this court also noted, Oregon has a transgender and intersex committee. But with respect to the statistic itself, that points to the outcome of ODOC's individualized assessment process. But it doesn't disprove the existence of that process and that that individualized assessments did, in fact, occur. The district court here, and its finding that ODOC has a default presumption was premised on just that aggregate number, because the declarations that plaintiffs had offered at most speak to individual instances of harm. The national statistic that they had offered is not specific to Oregon, and was not relevant to the time period either. So that only piece of evidence that remains is just the aggregate number of transgender women who are housed in men's facilities throughout the state. And that the district court's reliance on just that aggregate number of the outcome to then infer that, in fact, those individualized assessments did not occur is illogical, and that's unsupported by the record. On reconsideration, instead of holding plaintiffs to their burden of making an affirmative showing, the district court instead doubled down on its core default presumption finding. It explained that if defendants had had evidence that other AICs made affirmative requests to be housed in men's facilities, the court assumes that it would have offered such evidence. The district court also emphasized that the numbers speak for themselves, but the numbers cannot speak for themselves, and that is not a valid basis for judicial fact-finding. There are two issues with respect to what the district court did on reconsideration. The first is that an inference based on a mere assumption is just speculation.
Excuse me, I didn't hear that.
An inference made on just a mere assumption, as the district court noted, that it assumes defendants would have offered evidence, is just speculation. It's illogical and unsupported by the evidence. It's not logical to conclude that most prisoners have not made transfer requests simply because there's no evidence in the record to that effect. The district court also committed legal error by shifting the burden to defendants rather than holding plaintiffs to their burden of establishing that the law and facts clearly favor them as to their position. Because the district court committed the legal error in shifting the burden and also made clearly erroneous factual findings, and its analysis of each winter factor fails. Each winter factor was premised on this default presumption finding, and plaintiffs had failed to make an affirmative showing. Also address
counsel on page 27 of the plaintiff's answering brief. The brief cites three Ninth Circuit cases for the proposition that a party can rely on statistical evidence to infer a policy. Are those cases distinguishable? Is the inference support? Can an inference be supported based on statistics alone? Curious as to your thoughts.
Yes, Your Honor. I think those cases are distinguishable, and I would point this court to its decision in Parsons v. Ryan. That's 754 F3D 657, 2014 decision. That has explained that plaintiffs may pursue a class action under the Eighth Amendment against the state based on policies and practices of statewide and systemic application that expose all inmates in the state's custody to a substantial risk of serious harm. But a plaintiff can't satisfy the requirements of Rule 23 this is a quote from this court's decision, utterly threadbare allegations that a group is exposed to illegal policies and practices. Plaintiffs need to
what
point
page
to
Parsons you're looking at?
That's page 683, Your Honor.
Six what?
683.
83.
And this court explained on page 683 that a plaintiff cannot rely on utterly threadbare allegations that a group is exposed to illegal policies and practices. This court in Parsons also describes these policies as the glue that holds together the class. And absent any evidence of a policy existing, that class lacks the glue that would hold it together. At most,
But I think the question is, Why can't the district court infer from the stark pattern of outcomes that there is some operative rule at place, you know, at work in the system that produces that? That's essentially how I read the district court's order. What's wrong with that?
Your Honor, I think for the district court to reach that conclusion, it needed some evidentiary basis for why ODOC's individual assessments are unlikely to result in the outcome that most transgender women are housed in men's prisons. But the district court never identified anything in the record that would lend support to that assumption that it ultimately made. It just assumed that the numbers must have meant that ODOC has a default presumption instead of true individualized assessments.
And those cases that I referred to earlier are Title VII cases. And in Title VII cases, it may be often hard to prove motive. So the plaintiffs are left to rely on statistical evidence of outcome, as Judge Collins phrased it. And so if it's permissible in the Title VII context, why isn't it permissible here?
Your Honor, I think this is an Eighth Amendment case where plaintiffs have to show deliberate indifference to a substantial risk of serious harm. So I think those cases from the Title VII context are an opposite for the reason that Your Honor mentioned, and that motive with respect to Title VII is not the same standard as deliberate indifference in the Eighth Amendment context.
But they both require a showing of some kind of subjective awareness. Subjective intent. And the way to prove subjective intent, perhaps circumstantially, can be through statistical evidence, right? So if it can be proven in the Title VII context, why can't it be done here?
Your Honor, I think this court's decision in Parsons really emphasizing that just allegations are not sufficient. Makes clear why this can't proceed as a class. There may be individualized instances of harm that may proceed as individual cases, but there's no glue here, and there's nothing in the evidence currently to support a finding that there's that glue of the policy that exists to bind the class together.
Can I ask you a question about the scope of the district court's relief? When paragraph one says that ODOC must conduct prompt case-by-case housing and classification reviews, do you read that, or is everyone in agreement that that means that under this order you would now have to redo every placement anew? Is that what that language means?
I think that language is vague, but I think that's an interpretation that defendants have. This may require immediate prompt case-by-case analysis for every transgender inmate.
So everyone would have to be done afresh in accordance with the district court's order.
I think that's right, Your Honor.
Okay. And then what's the significance, if any? It was mentioned in the stay papers, but not in the merits briefs. What's the significance of the PLRA's 90-day expiration date?
Yes, Your Honor. Under the PLRA, the district court, the preliminary injunction will expire at the end of that 90-day window, it will expire unless the district court makes its need, narrowness, intrusiveness findings, and it makes the order final before the expiration of that 90-day window.
And 90 days runs from when, the date of the amended order?
I believe so. So that would be
not from the original order.
I don't believe so. I think
we said anything about whether orders can be renewed for another 90 days, or is it just one 90-day period?
This court recognizes rolling injunctions, and there are two ways that the district court can make its order final under the PLRA recognized in this court. The district court can enter a permanent injunction to make that preliminary relief final under the PLRA statute. But it can also issue another 90-day preliminary injunction. This court has recognized that practice under the PLRA.
In what case have we said that?
That's Edmo v. Corizon. That's 935 F3D 757. the 2019 decision, and it's found on footnote 12 on page 783. Edmo cites to Mayweather's, which was a 2001 decision from this court. That's 258 F3D 930. And there's a single sentence in Mayweather's that says, nothing in the PLRA limits the number of times a court may enter preliminary relief. There's a recent decision from the Fifth Circuit that has highlighted the reviewability issues of these rolling preliminary injunctions. Several judges in the Fifth Circuit, including Judge Jones and Judge Wilson, Judge Jones dissented from the denial of rehearing en banc in Voice of the Experience versus LeBlanc. That's 168 F4th.
50 or 60?
168.
68.
I apologize, Your Honor. 168 F4th, 339. Judge Jones has dissented and explained that for 2 years, its state had been held hostage to these serial interim but expiring injunctive decrees, but has been unable to obtain appellate review. There's also a statement by Judge Wilson, who had noted that under the practice of rolling injunctions, a court can functionally, the injunction itself can functionally evade review.
All right. I think you wanted to save time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. We've taken you over with questions, so I'll give you the 5 minutes you requested. And we will hear now from Mr. Burgess. Did I pronounce that correctly? All right. You may proceed when you're ready.
Excuse me. Good afternoon. May it please the court, John Burgess for plaintiff's appellees. We request that the preliminary injunction and provisional class certification be affirmed. Because I see it as the central argument of the briefing from the state, I think I would like to just jump in to the presumption argument, both because it's central to their arguments, but also because it was central to the interim stay. But I think before we get into it, I think that we have to address the fact that defendants have repeatedly misconstrued what precisely is being ordered by the court and the significance of that evidence.
So what's your answer on that point to the question I asked about the meaning of paragraph one? Do you read paragraph one as requiring a de novo review of everyone now? They'd have to just start going through everyone who's currently in the system and redo it in accordance with the district court's order. Is that, it seems to say that. I just want to understand whether that's how the parties read it or whether that's been clarified in the record anywhere.
I would agree that is how it appears textually and in context as well. I think that's what it would entail.
Okay. There's no specific discussion in the record that clarifies that, but that's your understanding of it.
That was my understanding, and I think that understanding is borne out because earlier in the order, I believe it also references that they would have to be reassessed in order for it, because all of the previous assessments that would have been performed would have been tainted by the baseline presumption, as the court saw it, that given that context, it wouldn't make sense to simply impose it on future assessments based on the wording of the district court's order. Regarding the percentage, we certainly agree that it plays a prominent role in the district court's order, and we don't dispute that. But what we do dispute is that it is based on no evidence at all. So the primary argument asserted by the defendants is that assumption is premised on no evidence in the record, and there is evidence in the record. And the district court.
As I understand it, their primary argument is that you can't just look at a lopsided outcome and then infer from that that there is some sort of inappropriate criterion that's being applied that produces it. In the civil rights context or Title VII context, you would have to have similarly situated. You have to have some analysis. You can't just look at the disparate outcome and then from that alone, without similarly situated comparators, draw an inference from that. Isn't that what the district court did here? It just took the outcome and then just inferred that there was an improper criterion without having any comparators or any basis for inferring that it was not the natural result of fair criteria?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of reasons why it's more than simply an inference from naked statistical data. So the first point to make is that the district court did acknowledge that they conduct individualized assessments. And there seems in the briefing from the defendants, it presents it as this binary. Either there's an individualized assessment occurs or there's a presumption that is applied, and they're not inconsistent. In fact, they're not even inconsistent in their own rules that they apply. So, for example, I would direct the court's attention to the policy that they've cited in their addendum. At addendum 7 of policy 40.1.13, it does not state that there is no default presumption. It states that housing for transgender inmates, quote, will be conducted on a case-by-case basis.
It doesn't say there is a presumption, but you're saying, I understand, I see your point that say, well, in theory, you could have criteria, but also have a presumption. They're not necessarily mutually exclusive. But typically, you know, if we run into presumptions in the law all the time, and you'll see it's, if it's laid out, whether it's in a case or in some sort of statute, it'll say there's this presumption, and then there's these criteria, you know, so it's a rebuttable presumption, right? But it does seem kind of weird to have criteria that don't mention a presumption. And then, I understand your point in the lower court's point that, well, there's a presumption, there's an implicit presumption, but the fact that there's no written, that there's criteria, no written out presumption, wouldn't that normally normally you would interpret that as there not being a presumption? You know, you have somebody comes in, they have intake, you look at all the criteria and you make a decision with no presumption. So am I right in thinking that I understand your point that they don't necessarily logically inconsistent, but I think, and I got this vibe from the district court's order that, and what is your position on this? That if they are applying a presumption, that is contrary to what their policy is.
Thank you. Yeah, and I think that I just want to take the first part of that, and I'm not trying to ignore the question.
No, I
think so. An important place to look is that actually the policies that have been identified by the defendants have multiple sections. At the beginning, at addendum 6, at C1, it actually indicates that all inmates are undergo an individualized assessment under PREA in order to determine their vulnerableness or aggressiveness in order to determine their appropriate housing. Nobody is contesting that cisgendered individuals who undergo that PREA assessment are housed not only based on a presumption, but a universal separator of the sexes in prison, which is unsurprising. And so to try and answer your question, I think that in many contexts, the absence of an asserted default might not be evidence that there is either one way or the other, or that it might be more appropriately evidence that there is no default.
Because there's the whole population of the prison that has a default.
Right. Well, and also I think it's in the context of the fact,
counsel, your argument is that there is a default presumption with respect to a particular class of inmates, right? Transgender inmates.
Yes.
So we're not worried about the non-transgender inmates. With respect to the transgender inmates, you're saying there is a default presumption that they be placed in men's prisons. And as I read the record, and in particular Jones's declaration, where he specifies the intake process, describes it, and he says, if an inmate presents as binary or, you know, transgender, then that inmate will be placed in an infirmary pending committee review. And based on the inmate's requests, preferences, you know, safety factors, the committee will then decide where to place that inmate. That doesn't sound like a default presumption there. Now, so we have that category of inmates, inmates who identify as transgender at the point of entrance or entry into the prison system. But then you have another category of inmates who, subsequent to their initial entrance, could be years later, where then they then identify as transgender. And at that point, you're saying there's a default presumption. I mean, I'm not quite sure that's it's an apt description of what happens there. It depends on whether they want to request a transfer or other kind of factors that go into the review. And there's periodic review as well. So, I mean, in light of all that, I'm not quite sure I see the default presumption.
Thank you. I think that, so a couple of things to point out. So in the supplemental declaration of Jones, it does identify a process. I think it's important to note that there's a kind of, I think there's a little bit of ambiguity that might not be obvious to those unfamiliar with Department of Corrections, but they're placed in the infirmary in a place that they've described as Coffee Creek Intake Center. The Coffee Creek Intake Center is where all inmates, whether male or female, are taken into DOC custody and then transferred to another facility. Being placed in the infirmary, I grant you that it shows a treatment that's distinguishable from non-transgender individuals. So a woman comes into intake center, they're not going to be placed in the infirmary unless they're unwell, presumably. And then they are automatically housed in the facility, Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, which is in the same compound or building, but it's the women's section of the prison that is separate from the intake center. So, and I grant you that that wasn't really well clarified in the documents. But I think that the fact that they undergo an analysis of where to house them, I think that what is being done here is trading upon an ambiguity about institution versus unit. Inmates are routinely assessed to determine what would be both a safe prison and a safe unit and a safe cellmate. In fact, that whole process is also described in the addendum provided by the defendants, which describes that you weigh whether or not somebody is potentially vulnerable versus potentially aggressive, and people are housed in ways to try and obviously avoid mixing individuals.
So it seems like your argument is the mere fact that they're getting an assessment doesn't mean they're getting the assessment that the policy says they're getting or that these declarations say they're getting. And I suppose that could be true, but I guess that kind of takes us back to, other than the statistics, the numbers, what is the evidence? I mean, it's just speculation that that's not what they're getting. If the numbers were something that made your clients happier, you know, that they were pleased with, what would they point to that would show that this assessment is not what the state says it is?
Well, and I want to be clear that I don't read the district court's findings to imply that what Mr. Jones is saying occurs at intake did not happen. What I read the judge to be saying is, yes, that's presumably what happens, because
it seems an inescapable part, a load-bearing part of the district court's analysis that, you know, if you were doing this without a presumption and you're doing this individualized process, and I accept you're doing an individualized process, you wouldn't get this outcome. We wouldn't see so many placements in the male prison. What's that assumption based on? Why would we expect it to be different? Is there any evidence that, you know, the population coming in has demonstrated preferences to go differently than what ended up? That's, where does this come from?
I agree. So, and I'm not, and I want to make sure that I understand your question, because in the briefing, I think that what you're describing was sort of separated into two different arguments. One was the argument from the defendants that of the 94% of individuals that were housed in men's of the individuals, only 26 of them had requested Coffee Creek, and therefore, why doesn't that lower percentage imply that the outcomes that you see, i.e. 94% is in men's prisons and 8 individuals at Coffee Creek, is not just the outcome of those individuals' stated preferences. And
that's one of the things, but that's not the only thing. I mean, because state of preference is not the only factor that the state says they're taking into account. The other, they take into account whether that person would be dangerous for them to be, take into account whether it would be dangerous to the prison population, all kinds of things like that. So, I guess the question is how do the numbers, how can we draw on the inference that it appears like the district court drew from the number? I mean, do you disagree? Judge Collins' question, he said it seems like a load-bearing part is that of the district court's order, and I have the same impression, but that the low-bearing part of that is this: these numbers, the numbers wouldn't be what they are if you were doing what you said you were doing. And do you agree with that characterization, or do you think something, is there some other, are we reading it wrong? Am I reading it wrong?
I don't think either of you are reading it wrong. I agree with the premise of the question, which is that the district court looked at the numbers and said, this kind of outcome, roughly 94%, is indicative of a presumptive practice. And presumably the same would be true if defendants...
That's where the Title VII analogy doesn't help you, because you can't just say, I applied this particular employment criterion and I got a lopsided outcome. You wouldn't be able to establish a prima facie case without showing that the pool had a different distribution of the criterion being measured and say it's lopsided because the pool is actually 50-50, but when they do it, they end up 90-10. That it would be the disparity that would produce it, not right. Just the fact that if the incoming community is 90-10 and then you apply a neutral criterion and you end up with 90-10, there's nothing wrong. That's what's missing here, is you're looking at the 90-10 or whatever the numbers are, but you don't have a baseline. There's just nothing. And so that's the gap they're pointing at, saying the district court just speculated that it would have been different if you were doing something different, but that is based on nothing. What's your response to that?
Well, I don't think it's based on nothing. I mean, so I think, first of all, if we back up, obviously the historical practice of housing people in prisons is that men are in men's prisons and women are in women's prisons. That's the historical baseline that pre-existed any policy that ODOC might have relating to transgender inmates. And that has continued to be the case, that those that were, whose birth sex is male, are housed in men's prisons, regardless of whether they're requesting them or not, is the overwhelming majority. It's close to 95%. The district court can look at a statistic like that. The problem with the analogy, I grant you, with a Title VII case is they are different, but they're different in ways that are both helpful and harmful, I guess I would say, because there's no incoming pool that's analogous in the prison context like there is in an employment discrimination lawsuit.
Well, it is, because the flavor of the district court's order is that, gee, I would have thought that most male to female transgenders would want to go to the women's prison. And that seems to be the background assumption here. And it doesn't appear to be based on anything. That's That's what I'm struggling with here.
Well, I mean, I think there's the numbers, and then defendants offered a response, which was effectively saying that the absence of evidence, that the outcome reflected preference rather than a baseline, and the district court just said, I'm not going to...
Well, I think the response, I think the response was, or at least should have been, because I think it is your burden to show that this assumption, which maybe that's true, I don't know, but that the majority of transgender inmates would want to be in the gender they identify with, as opposed to, but I just don't, I don't know if there's any basis for that. And there's the 8 versus, is it 22 or 27? I can't remember. There's the 8 versus, you know, and that's, I suppose, could be meaningful, but I don't know that it, but the rest of it, the 91 remaining, I mean, I just don't know what that means. It's at least theoretically possible that they didn't request a transfer because they don't want to. In other words, like, I suppose it's possible that a majority don't want to, and that would be completely counter to the assumption, it seems like.
Well, I think there's also an issue, which is that it's being mapped onto a binary system, but the district court is discussing possibilities other than simply placing transgender women at Coffee Creek. There's actually other alternatives, and it's clear from the declarations that some of the transgender inmates that supplied declarations in this case would have preferred housing in certain locations because they felt that it was safer. So, for example, one of the declarants, his name will come to me in a moment, indicated that they preferred being in one portion of SRCI, which is a men's facility in DOC, and that they felt unsafe in corridor 2 or the other portion of the prison. And so whether or not you are, you know, the numbers reflect the preferences has to be based on, one, what those preferences are, and also what the universe of options that were available to them and their knowledge. And I think in the absence of that, you can't assume that it would have been the product of their preferences as opposed to an underlying default, which the district court...
But I'm not sure you can assume the opposite either. That I guess, is that's the challenge of this, is maybe you can't assume one way, but it does feel like the judge here assumed the other way. And I'm not sure you can do that, especially if you all have the burden.
I gave them an extra minute, so you can, if we were asking you questions, you can keep
okay
going.
I appreciate that. I think that given I think in the context of the declarations of people's intention to be wanting to be safe and not wanting to be housed in general population men's prisons because it subjects them to a heightened likelihood of physical and sexual assault, I think the district court properly concluded that these assignments are based on a centralized process. And that's also borne out in the addendum, the rule itself in the addendum, which indicates that the assignments are done irrespective of somebody's request. Those are supposed to be done twice yearly, I believe is what it says, or two times a year, in which case whether or not they got housed at X prison would be the product of an assessment that occurred without necessarily any of their input. So because of that, I think it's safe to assume that it was based on the preferences of the prison. That is a reasonable assumption based on the context of the rules and the statistical outcomes.
One final question. Does the record cast any light on what might be included in the category of other protective placements?
Yeah. I mean, I think the record is a little thin on that subject. I would agree, in part also because it indicates voluntary transgender units and other protective custody. I think given the context that Coffee Creek is the only women's prison in DOC, in the DOC system, presumably both voluntary transgender units and other protective custody would be modifications within an existing men's prison to allow for protection. And I think that was listed explicit, but also the rules themselves indicate a use of something called administrative administrative housing unit, which is what happens in response to PREA investigations. People are housed there, and there are special rules within the addendum rule that describe how long that can go and to make sure that it doesn't result in punitive outcomes like loss of educational opportunities and other other things that other individuals in the prison would have access to. So I assume that something like other protective custody would be a, for lack of a better way of putting it, a softer, less violent, less a unit less likely to produce violent sexual assaults against transgender inmates. Okay.
All right. Thank you, Counsel. All right, we'll hear rebuttal.
I'll focus on the statistical evidence. I would just note that there are many reasons for why the outcome might have resulted, and the district court conceded here that it assumed why the outcome was what it was. The AAC, an inmate can choose to remain in a current placement, and many do. Most transgender women identify themselves as transgender to ODOC after they're already housed in a men's facility. Some prisoners, after they are at intake, are housed at Coffee Creek. That's reflected in the Jones Declaration and the Supplemental Jones Declaration. I'll also just note, with respect to these voluntary transgender units that have been brought up in the briefing and today at argument, that that's inconsistent with the PREA Prison Rape Elimination Act. That's 28 CFR section 115.42, which is reflected in ODOC's policy 40.1.13, states that an agency can't place transgender inmates in dedicated facilities or wings solely on the basis of their identification unless that placement is in connection with a consent decree, a legal settlement, or a legal judgment. A preliminary injunction is not a legal judgment and certainly not one that expires after 90 days.
I mean, that's kind of an odd rule for a court to apply because it basically says you can't do it unless the court wants it and doesn't tell the court what criteria to apply. And it kind of seems either irrelevant or a bootstrap.
That's the language from the Prison Rape Elimination Act, and those are the standards for the Prison Rape Elimination Act. I think plaintiffs have repeatedly brought up that one of the possibilities, which is reflected in the terms of the preliminary injunction here, is that there may be voluntary transgender units, but absent some settlement or consent decree, that's the state would be violating the Prison Rape Elimination Act by doing it. So I will just note that there are many reasons for the aggregate outcome of ODOC's individualized assessment process. The state has presented specific reasons for why Plaintiff JF and the declarants, when they had requested to be housed at Coffee Creek, those requests were denied. And if the court has no further questions.
Counsel, I just wanted to ask about the second factor of the Winter test, irreparable harm. You didn't address it in the reply brief, and I suppose if we find for you on the first prong, we don't need to reach the rest, but plaintiff's counsel in his briefing has made the argument that if we take the declarant's assertions of the harm that they experienced and they've been exposed to as true, as the district court did, then wouldn't that amount to irreparable harm?
Your Honor, I think for the balance of the equities and public interest, I think those would weigh in favor of the state. The state does have an interest in the efficient administration of its prison system, and the district court here has micromanaged the state's
administration of its prison system. So I think on the whole, those factors would not weigh in favor of plaintiffs.
That goes to the third and fourth prongs of Winter, though. I'm talking about the second prong. So why are plaintiffs wrong when they say they would suffer irreparable harm?
Your Honor, I think they point to past alleged instances of harm, and there's no indication in the record or argument from plaintiffs that they would face similar instances.
I understood your argument to be that both sides have a risk of irreparable harm. You're not contesting that, you know, if they had a likelihood of success on the merits, they have a showing of irreparable harm in terms of if they win and the district court's view of the record and the facts, that there is a risk of sexual violence or being faced with such a thing is clearly irreparable harm, right?
Your Honor, I think that's correct, and I also
so
think
it's... both have a showing of irreparable harm, but as I understand your argument, it's that you have the stronger showing on the merits, you have a showing on irreparable harm, and then the equities weigh in your favor ultimately.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I think I would just, for irreparable harm, also just emphasize the state's interest in running its prison system without the micromanagement of this federal district court, I think, go to the showing of irreparable harm for the state. So I think you're correct, Your Honor, that the state also has irreparable harm that has it has shown here.
All right. Thank you. Okay. All right. Thank you, counsel. The case just argued be submitted. We thank counsel for their helpful arguments in this case. And this court for this session stands adjourned.
All right. Do you hear ye, all persons having had business with the Honorable United States